Okay, this is the Machico Sakita. Machico Sakita climb. First of all, Don, how did the Machico Sakita group contact you?
Well, by mail.
Okay.
Also in the middle 50s, many, many Japanese expeditions, usually the first ones were from Kansai University, Meiji University, Watsuya University, the universities of Japan sent over several scientific climbs, which had unlimited landing clearance for the park system. Meiji University was one. And so when the survey was underway, the word was out that here's the possibility of landing near these routes of the climbs. They study biology, entomology, glaciology, cosmic ray observations, and scientific aspects. And later, of course, the Institute of Arctic Biology with their space age physiology teams came in. Starting off, the first one was the Smith expedition in 60. And later on, they had an accelerated program from 67 through 70 with the Institute of Arctic Biology and Professor Morrison. Mm-hmm. Okay, as a matter of fact, the winter climb was one of the Institute of 60, that's in January 67, mm-hmm. the Institute of Arctic Biology testing laboratory deal.
Right.
Around through the squirrel cage. Now, word's out that you can get to the mountain. So, we get correspondence all winter and all summer, spring and fall. Climate teams whirled around. Can you land us here? Can you land us there? I'm sure. So, away we went, including the Machico Sakita. Now, it was a team of the finest rock climbers in all Japan.
How many were there?
Five.
And where specifically in Japan were they from?
Well, I could look their address up.
Well, were they from? Were they university now?
No, they were from a climbing team of Japan, and they were composed of rock climbers, which is different than ice climbers, in a point of view. In technical rock climbing, your hardware is different. In the case of McKinley, on the Jakey Breedenbaugh route, the route, only one successful climb was made without a fatal accident. The Smith expedition lost two members. Machico Sakita lost three on the Breedenbaugh route. He was later in a fatal avalanche in Nepal, over in the Himalayas. But anyway, he pioneered the route of the Southwest Buckers, and it's a rough, tough one. Tough Dutchman and a tough route. So, anyway, by mail, I got a request. And as the months roll by, I look forward to the all-girl Japanese climbing team. I've taken the first crew, the Denali Damsels, led by Grace Vincent Holman, on the first successful all-girl climb of McKinley. One of her team members was from Australia. She was an Austrian. By birth, American naturalization, and they were each from a different location, geographically. Anyway,
Don, when did that Holman thing, that damsel climb, go?
I guess in about 69, and later she was involved in a fatal fall. She and Hans Wanderlaan, an engineer, mm-hmm. wiped out in the Kootenai Glacier avalanche, and at her last request, and unbeknown to me, in her will, she requested that that she be scattered to the
winds. Oh, yeah,
on
okay.
Her route.
We got that, yeah.
Okay. So, Machico Sakita arrived. Five very lively, pert little Japanese flowers of womanhood. Small, delicate, and skis and their flowers and their T-sets and doilies, and I took them immediately to the glacier, and they set up their tents on the second load. They had everything ready to go for a tea party, and they were a refreshing sight, because they're all tremendous skiers.
Yeah.
Plus, they were the best talent in the rock climbing department in Japan, which is saying a lot for millions of climbers.
Now, you took them up on the hill?
Right, the 7,000 foot. And they were merrily on the way, and they moved down the glacier, East Fork, and up the main route of the west approach, and the snow just crackled, and away they went.
Now, they were skiing up in there, or they
were
climbing?
Yeah, they were skis.
They were skiing.
So, they, in short order, arrived at the base of the Wheaton Ball Southwest Buckus, and the climb began. I had lots of traffic in the area, and I watched them closely.
Oh, what altitude is the base of the Buckus?
9,000. So they went 2,000 vertical and 10 lateral miles. Bad capacity, no accidents. And then, you notice, they made an amazing climb on the face of the sheer buttress. Vertical overhangs, no problem. Zap, zow, and it was over and gone to the next one. And I lost them at 16,000 because a storm hit. It seemed to be a bad altitude. The terrible winds were low, chill factors paralyzed.
Now, how long a time period are we talking about here, Don? From when you first set them down and they had the tea party,
2 weeks.
To when they disappeared in the storm,
2 weeks. Well, yeah, but the thing was, one of the members at 16,000, it later developed, she had a perforated ulcer. Rough and tough, healthy as anything, and she developed an ulcer and perforated ulcer. And, I picked her up at the 8,700 foot level.
You remember her name by any chance?
No, but it's record someplace. I can write to Machiko. Anyway, the thing was, Machiko brought her down as a storm crashed into the mountain.
She developed the ulcer at 8,000.
No, she had the ulcer.
Perforated the ulcer at 8,000. Okay.
Somewhere in route, she developed the ulcer. Or aggravated. And so then, Chico brought her 9 for a message out. I saw a message.
How did you do that?
I'm flying by, I'm looking for a written message in the snow.
Oh.
That's the way we communicate when they have a rating. See? It's real good. Trent, the letters with your skis, in their case, 10 feet high, you can read them 3 miles. She says, sit, party member, please land. Got her a note saying, move sick party member to 8,700 foot level, main glacier. Go pick up. And I did. Well, in the meantime, Chico went over this tremendous crevasse and drove the 7,000 foot level to get another load of gear and then climbed the complete southwest Wheaton Ball route solo.
She went back
for
up.
Her other members. Couldn't find them. She climbed to the top of McKinley solo. Uemura, the great solo climber. He was supposed to have been the first solo climber on McKinley. Thinking about it, never occurred to me before. But it's Machiko Sakita that's the first solo climber in McKinley. She climbed it looking for her lost crew members. And they left the 16,000 foot area with one day's food and left the camp right there. They're going to make a zap trip up and back to the camp. All secured. Well, a crew led by a doctor whose name Roberto was just coming off the summit at 19. Thousand in the fatal Archdeacon's Tower area, and they tried to prevail on the Japanese Sakita team of 3 to please don't go up, the winds were picking. terrible storm moving in. Standing wave clouds are moving down the mountain. And the little Japanese gals couldn't be changed. They went disappearing into the standing wave clouds. They were the last they were ever seen until they spotted out of a helicopter, a commercial helicopter, that had been chartered by the Japanese consul, with Janae riding along as observer. I thought sure that I would locate them. I found the lost Wilcox party members, but I was wrong. The wind was blowing from the east, and the wind blew to the west. I blew back down the rock and fell almost a mile. And I looked right where they were at. Five different passes. And Janae said, the reason you didn't see him, he says, in a helicopter 50 feet above, we couldn't really see him. Because the crevasse portice caved off, and all we could see was just part of one jacket as we went by. It didn't look like a crack, so we looked around. So we came back to the radio station. Said they made it fine. No, he used the helicopter radio, said he made a plane.
Called you at Talkeetna, your radio.
The house. And I'd been looking for him for 5-6 days. I was sure I could find him back then. As I say, I was looking on the east side of the mountain that blew off the west side. But I looked right where they at, but they're covered with snow. But right 50 feet above them, today is looking and he saw them quick. Anyway, I put Janae back at Talkeetna, so I loaded. Husband of one of the members. And I moved him down. In the meanwhile, I got Shakita out of there.
She had gone up and came back down again. Where did you pick her up?
I got her at the 8,900 foot level, just above where Bat Key fell through the crevasses. Called the park up and told her, none, since she's back to Talkeetna, so you don't issue me any permits. So then we got Titus, Janae's friend, and the husband of one of the lost climbers. During this time, there's a lot of press to get the bodies of these climbers. Shikito was not going to be allowed back in Japan, it appeared, unless she made a discovery. So we was really helping. Anyway.
Now why would that be?
Well, she's captain of the team and she didn't control the team. They have military discipline on there. Apparently. Anyway. So I loaded four of them up with all her gear and landed them at 10,200 feet. That was last year. Not this summer, but last year. And I get up the pass and offloaded them and they walked up the mountain. They didn't want to land at 14 because they were in a crevasse of a little over 15,000. They wanted to get acclimatized. Anyway, they hiked up the mountain. Janae had a team on the mountain at the time of about a dozen guys, and they were holding at 14,000. Anyway, with the assistance of Titus and the husband of one of the climbers, Janae, of course, and Machiko Sakita, they recovered the bodies.
Machiko Sakita went with them.
Yeah, took her.
Wasn't this in 71, Don?
Well, no, because I used a turbo job to get them up there. That was last year. It didn't happen then.
What was this, last year?
Hell yes. Not this summer, but 72. Uh, I'm positive of it because I never had this turbo system. Yeah.
Huh.
You change that.
Yeah.
You change that. That's last year, 72.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
see, when you go over things, even about half in the bag, why you...
Yeah, right. You pick out errors. 72. Yes. I thought you got this.
I got that plane, both of them, in June, and we worked till the last of July to get the radios and everything installed. I only had 350 hours from the engine blew up last year and this year. Mountain flying. Just special mountain flying. That's all.
Well, Michiko Sakito was in there a year ago last.
That's right. July, probably.
Okay, so you flew them out of there. They brought the bodies then back down to where? 14-3, and you took them out of your strip at 14-3 of the Cub.
And stockpiled them at 7 and picked them all up and assessed them.
Oh, I see.
7.
Hmm. Brought them down to Talkeetna. Yeah. Okay. She's running.
Yeah. Well, what I had in mind was a better and a more vivid demonstration on the McCutcheon old-fashioned moose hunt. Now, I want to add a few items. One is, I want to qualify McCutcheon first as being the greatest legal mind that ever graced the lands of Alaska. Here's why. Most of the legal minds had a chance to take the case of the Taiwanese Indians versus the U.S. Department of the Interior. The reason? The Department of the Interior leased the Taiwanese Indian Reservation to Standard Oil for oil exploration and angle drilling under the reservation. Now, McCutcheon had for years been friends of the destitute when off-season fishing was poor, and the good seasons, he was their friend. He hauled many of the members back and forth from their villages. He was the great outdoor type, and he mingled with the people of the villages, and he was their council d'affaires at no charge, since only once in a while did they hit a good season when they could either trap in the winter and the conditions might be right when they could make some money trapping, or when they hit a bumper crop salmon fishing season in the lower inlet, he was sometimes reimbursed for some of his efforts. But being a born true Alaskan, his interests at heart were always with the people of Alaska. He was one himself. He's still one of the great members of the old guard of Alaska. Alaskan comes first. So personally and single-handed, at the request of the Taiwanese Indian chief, he took on this ponderous task of approaching the Department of the Interior in regard to this possible infringement of Aboriginal rights against the Taiwanese villagers for whom Interior Department had granted oil leases under and on the Taiwanese Indian Reservation. It clearly states in the Constitution that in the realm of Aboriginal rights, such a thing as this cannot happen, but it did. Now, McCutcheon made a trip to Washington. He's a tremendous public speaker. He's a member of our old territorial legislature. He's a man of great of mental means. Plus, he knows the problems, and he has the answers to most of the problems. This is legal problems and other types of problems. He's one of the great experts of mining law of Alaska. He settled and won more hassles in mining law than any combination of other lawyers that I can think of. Furthermore, he's retained as far away as Texas in mining law, in the field of which he is the expert. Okay. Now, against when approaching Department of Interior, you talk to people with blind eyes, deaf ears, and locked doors in regard to the great U.S. Department of Interior infringement on the lowly Indians, the villagers of Tyonic, the great legal means of the United States Treasury is behind the Interior Department. That means all of the gold in Fort Knox is going to prove in a legal case through delays if necessary that the Interior Department is always right. McCutcheon is a party of one. Set out to prove the Interior Department was 180 degrees wrong, and he made the Interior Department believe it. The Supreme Court Justice of the United States of America awarded the Tyonic Indians $11.5 million on the Interior Department's first payment to the Tyonic Indians. And this is a matter of fact, and I hope you check it out. All right, now this qualifies McCutcheon in just one tiny area as being the outstanding legal mind of Alaska. If for no other reason, his deal to justify the Tyonic Indians' plight. All right. Now, I've already said that McCutcheon was an ardent outdoorsman. His idea of fun is to go wrestle a bear if one is convenient. And he's a tremendously strong man. And he got his training, not through his legal training, not through college degree, but the devious route of being a protege of the great Grigsby. And Grigsby, along with Judge Wickersham and some of the other early legal experts of Alaska, refereed the mining disputes from one end of Alaska to the other. Judge Diamond among them. And it was in these courts that McCutcheon got his training without formal college education. And he entered the bar at the minimum age of 21. And he came out fighting. And he told me he carefully prepared his first case. And he lost it. And a man went to jail. He said after that, he learned the lesson. No one in the legal business more meticulous than Stanley McCutcheon. He pursues the most ragged detail. He's a good photographer. He's got a mind like an IBM machine. He knows a lot about anatomy. He put in a hitch in a morgue. He said, as a matter of fact, on one of his first days at the morgue, they had several clients. Now, down on C Street, there were other operations in addition to this morgue. This is in Anchorage. Some of the ladies of the night also, and some of the imbibing fishermen. Wandered in and out the various establishments. Well, on the second night, as an assistant in the morgue, McCutcheon was shocked to find he was early, for his appointment. He was supposed to be there at a certain time, and he got there a few minutes early, and the door was open. And so he assumed that the undertaker was in the morgue. He walked in the morgue and started to do some menial chores of which he had been instructed the first day. As I said, there were several clamps stretched out on the slabs under various stages of completion for the trip down to the one-way path at the cemetery. And he was just sweeping down the aisle. He went past two, three, and he went by the fourth customer, and he's sweeping, not looking around, and he inadvertently stuffed the end of his broom handle in the fourth client's ribs, and the fourth client got up with a big grunt.
Oh, jeez.
And McCutcheon exploded through the back door and never went back for 3 days.
Yeah, I imagine.
It had been one of the clients in one of the local bars. Thought he was at another bar. There was a bed handy. No covers on it, but it would be a good place to go to sleep. Okay, so much for some background on McCutcheon. Yeah. Now, I want to add some other things. In the legal trade, I had no legal experience. I'm about to, I don't think you have the tape on the hillbilly. The FAA versus grounding of Talkeetna Air Service.
No.
All right. Let's continue first with a moose hunt. Now, I already attempted, and I hope you get the flavor, to qualify McCutcheon as a great lawyer. Not a great lawyer, but the great lawyer. Okay. Now, I want to reemphasize that as McCutcheon was whistling away, putting the fat piles of moose chops, the T-bones in one sack, the porterhouses in another sack, and the ground round chunks in another sack, and loading them into his old beat-up 170, it was at this time, with the job half complete, that their wine developed into the configuration of the Chief Justice of Alaska, Buell Nesbitt's new, shiny, powerful airplane. See? This is a beautiful fall day. It's crisp. The leaves are changing color. The tundra's very compatible. Now, I mentioned, I went through the razzle-dazzle of the first pass. And then I said, on the third pass, a precision poach was drug in from 3 miles out. A successful touchdown was made. This new powerful plane, the big engine, was heavy. The reason he overshot the lake was because the lake was too small, way too small. And I want to emphasize the sound of the crash, because McCutcheon explained in detail to me that he was absolutely, first it was a joke that the pass was made with the intention of landing. The next pass got more serious. The landing was disaster in capital words. McCutcheon knew he couldn't stop in 350 feet. All right, beyond this particular pun, I said, there was piles of stumps and broken beaver dams, snagged swamp spruce. Okay, the plane never lost any speed at all. Hit a beautiful touchdown, used up the 350 feet like it was pure grease, and went into the beaver dams with one tremendous magnitude 1 crash. The smoke flew. The pieces flew. It jarred the ptarmigan out of the pucker brush. It was one hell of a crash. I want you to get that. There was a cow and a calf moose ran for their lives. Never heard anything like it. And McCutcheon was absolutely horrified. Here he'd shot his rifle. He'd waved the moose hide. He'd jumped up and down. He'd screamed. When the third pass looked like the final finish. And now all that's left over there is a bunch of scattered wreckage. The plane's broken up. Part of it's upside down. There's not a sound now. It's deathly still. Just the smoke. Hot engine. Upside down in the water, smoking. Twisted fragments of metal. Floats all bent out of shape. Unrecognizable almost. Well, to get to this, you had to go the circuitous route, swim 2 or 3 leads, some beaver dug outs through the pucker brush and around through the reeds and the salt grass, and probably had to go 1,000 feet to get to it. Well, anyway, when he got to it, he still couldn't see anything. There was pieces. The plane had performed according to the way it was designed. It had progressively destroyed itself. And he noticed that the left-hand door, although the plane was upside down, was jarred clear off the airplane. And then he heard a gurgle. And he rushed around the plane, and here, very dignified, tall, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Alaska, still trapped to the seat, trying to extract his head from the moss and the tundra. And McCutcheon went over and in one fell swoop, helped separate him from the water and a musk cake, and got him right side up and asked him if he was hurt. And he said that Nesbitt staggered around, got oriented, and McCutcheon said, "I thought you'd had it. I thought you'd had it. I tried to wave you off. I waved the moose hide. I shot all my ammunition. I screamed."
Yeah.
Well, he says, "Why did you do it? Why did you do it? You knew it was too short." And then, at that point, the great Nesbitt said, "If McCutcheon could do it, I could do it."
Yeah.
Now, yeah. Well, and the other part, on the explanation of the weather, on the Jattinger pickup. Now, you have to see it to believe it. If you want a change in the weather on McKinley, just wait a few minutes. In the case of frontal passages, this is true. You get water and clouds clear over the 20,000 foot level. You'll get hail and clouds down to the base of McKinley, the hottest day of the summer. You get snow someplace almost every day in showers. So, what I wanted to say was that when I went back to Talkeetna, the terrible blow was moving in. These are frontal passages. They're occluded fronts. They're a mixture of warm, unstable air and a slightly colder air moving through in frontal passages, individual storms in mass. making for turbulence and mixed air. Okay. When air mixes, it gets rough. When it gets rough, it changes temperatures. Therefore, it could snow. If there are high pressure, warm fronts are usually low pressure. When mixed with cold, they can be anything. This gives you icy conditions. Anyway, what happened was, I said, Janae called at 6 in the morning. I questioned him on the HF radio. I said, Janae, you say it's clear. To blow that storm out of there, I could see it clear to Bristol Bay. Must have took a cyclone. What's the wind? I want you to get it down, if possible, that always the optimistic mountaineer will play down winds and bad conditions and play up the good conditions in order to get the job done. And this leaves a fellow flying in a plane trying to get the job done in a precarious position. Right. You have to understand what they say is not necessarily true. Your job is to make up your own mind. Institute of Arctic Biology Professor Morrison gave me a lesson in economics along that line. I very nearly lost an airplane on several occasions because they thought, not knowing too much about flight, that as soon as they could see the sun, even though it was obscured in all quadrants except straight overhead, this was good flying weather. They didn't understand that you have to approach at 15,000, set up your rate of descent, land at full power at 70 miles an hour in order to maintain enough speed to make a turnaround as the speed dissipates at the extreme buttress turnaround approaching from the west to the east. You're landing into the face of a cliff that's more than a mile high right over your head. And it's got to be close. And if you have turbulence that ruins your aim, you're approaching at 15,000 to make a 14.3 landing. In cold air, you might find that you have a 2,000 foot rate of sink or a 3,000 foot turbulent rate of rise. This ruins your aim. And you can't go around. The performance airplane won't allow it.
Where do you draw the line, Don? Where do you say?
Well, you draw the line.
In other words, where do you abort your landing?
I on one or two of the Institute of Arctic Biology landings and on several of Janae's landings, I nearly stacked the airplane by landing short. This is bad news. On Kitchen's first landing, I landed, made it. I'm waiting for Helga Beatty. I talked to Kitchen on the radio. I said, Kitchen, you see where I'm at? He said, yeah. Okay, I'm breathing oxygen. I don't know a capability yet. I never landed that high before. This is May 18th, 1916. I said, Kitchen, I want you to listen to me, and I'm going to tell you one thing, one time. I'm putting markers out, and it's rough, but not too rough, and I want you to land full power at the first marker at 70 miles an hour. He said, yes, yes. He said, boy, it says I'm at 16,000, I can't breathe, kind of a heavy smoker. Well, I'd given him some of the Air Force oxygen, and he was working on the pure oxygen. But he's still game. So I say, okay, you want to concentrate. Instead of throttling back on the touchdown, you must give it full power with the heat off and the mixture lean to the proper power setting with the maximum RPM so that you will be able to make the turnaround. So in horror, I watched the kitchen come in too slow. And in horror, I watched him throttle the engine. And he landed at 40 miles an hour, about 1,500 feet down the face. And it took 3 hours with 8 men pushing, 4 on each side of that Super Cub, to get him back up to where he should have stopped and turned around to start with. And then he's a pretty good scout because he took off, threw out all of his emergency gear, come back, landed, did it right the next time, and completed 5 successful freight and passenger hauls out of there. 2 other pilots, good qualifications, failed miserably and didn't haul anybody out of there. One of them didn't even land. One of them landed and nearly stacked his airplane.
Who were the 8 guys, you and him, and who else?
The Hardy, some rescue climbers, and members of the Wilson, held the baiting crew. Metzger.
Cruz was there.
Huh?
Metzger and Cruz brought her down.
Yeah. I waited for them. Yeah. Boy, they didn't have to wait on me. I waited on them.
Yeah, right.
Details. See, I wanted to point out the whys. They're lowering her down in the Ocho, tied in the Ocho. And you got to know that somebody dying of lack of oxygen infects their mind. If you want, Institute of Audiology, because they write the books on physiology of altitude, thought they could send their middle-aged doctors, professors, and experts up there, get off at 14.3 and go to work. And man, I hauled a lot of them back. Some of them straight to Fort Wainwright. And
that's just this one.
Anyway, you got to be young, hopefully, and be in good physical condition, and preferably a non-smoker.
Yeah.
Make it.
Yeah.
And it makes a difference. Boy, that they're not kidding when they say smoking will wipe you out. Anyway.
Just about done with it.
Yeah, well, look, I want to tell you about the cloud signals on McKinley. For years, 5-6 years, I confused the tip-off in the clouds